charged him for filling out the paperwork that he had to send to the government in order to get him released. He charged him $45 for the dinner of tacos that they had that night. And then he told Neri that he had to go find his own place to live, find a job, and start paying back this debt. And, you know, Neri doesn't speak any English. He's never worked. He was in school when he was in Central America. And we've seen the text messages between him and this man. The man starts threatening him and saying, "You don't matter to me. I'm going to mess you up." He threatened Neri's family. And these kids are just on their own in these situations, which with, you know, very little resources and very few ways out.
Now, you mentioned that federal inspectors just generally are not looking for these kinds of violations. But I'm sure that several of these workplaces that you went to were unionized in one degree or another. Is there any sense on your part that the organized labor movement was that leaders in some of these places were aware of this? And because they could certainly complain and therefore trigger some kind of inspection.
So many of these children are coming in through staffing agencies. I had initially thought that the unions would be a really important resource in this reporting. And when I went to them, they told me, no, there's no children here. You know, we have these other sort of workplace issues. But then in some cases, I would go back to the same workplace and see children on the night shift. And I think part of what's going on here is there's sort of two labor streams. There are the official employees, and those are people who have to provide government IDs. There's a lot more regulation and protection. And then there are these kids who come in through the staffing agencies. And that's like a total free-for-all, where the staffing agencies, people who work at the staffing agencies have told us that they know they're sending children to work at these factories. People who sent children to work packaging Cheerios say they knowingly did this and that the factory knowingly accepted these kids. But because there's sort of this one layer of remove, the factories don't get in trouble. It's the staffing agencies that get in trouble when there's a crackdown.
And the children who've died, Hannah?
I mean, child labor laws exist for a reason. They're not just there because kids should go to school and they should get enough sleep. They're really there because this work is dangerous. Kids are much more likely to get injured on the job, and they're supposed to protect kids' like physical safety. So what we found talking to these kids who are working jobs that they're not supposed to be in, that are illegal for children, is that the rate of injury is extremely high. And in some cases, children have died days after being released to a sponsor. In one case in Alabama, a 15-year-old fell 50 feet off of a warehouse where he was helping replace a roof. It was his first day on the job. He had been released to his brother. Here in Brooklyn, where I live, a 14-year-old was killed on his bike. He was a food delivery worker, and he was living in a house full of strangers trying to send money back to his family and was hit by a car. Another case that really struck me was a 16-year-old who died when he fell out of an earth mover that he was driving. And to me, the idea that a 16-year-old would be in a position to be driving a 35-ton vehicle is just inconceivable. But this is what happens when you have kids working the jobs that, for almost a century, they've been specifically prohibited from being in.
I want to bring Greg Chen into this conversation. Hannah Dreyer, who we're talking to, is the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter who did this just jaw-dropping expose, Alone and Exploited. Gregory Chen is the Senior Director of Government Relations for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Can you talk about, legally, what recourse these children have?
Thank you so much for having me on the show here. And this is an extremely challenging situation. And when you use the word legally, what recourse do these children have? The first thing that comes to mind for me as a practicing lawyer who represented children back in the 1990s in San Francisco is that children don't have any knowledge or understanding of what their legal rights are. Many of these children who are coming from different countries that have very limited English-speaking capacity or skills, and they simply won't understand that there is a legal system of labor laws to protect them. And they are also afraid that their immigration status here in the United States is going to be in jeopardy if they report any such violations.
I wanted to ask you, in terms of the response of the Biden administration, this is certainly one of the fastest responses by a government agency to an expose that I can recall. Your sense of what some of the proposals are of the Biden administration to address this issue?
So the announcements by the Biden administration are laudable in terms of the speed that they've implemented them or they've announced them. By and large, what they're talking about here is increasing Department of Labor and Health and Human Services investigations of these kinds of situations, and also improving the screening and vetting of families that might sponsor these children, usually relatives who are going to take care of the children after they are released from government custody, which happens when they first arrive. And then in addition, after these children are released, what kinds of post-release services are going to be given to these children to make sure to check on them so that after a month or 3 months, you know, are they still living there? What is their health situation? Are they going to school? Those are all steps that the federal government has announced they will be doing more of because they haven't been able to check on all these families. What is missing here, and this is very important given the fact that, as Hannah described, and what we're seeing statistically, is that the number of children coming to the United States, particularly from Central American countries, has increased dramatically. From about 10 years ago, we had 14,000 children coming every year. Now we are looking at 130,000 children that came just last year. And these are children who are fleeing persecution, violence, and poverty. And many of them are afraid to come to the United States because of the challenges crossing the border and because the United States has made it much more difficult to seek asylum. And when they get here, if they don't have stable humanitarian legal relief, such as asylum, they're going to be afraid to report anything bad that happens to them while here in the U.S., including labor violations. So what the Department of Homeland Security needs to do and the Biden administration need to do is to look at more ways of ensuring asylum access and humanitarian protection for children and for other people who are coming here seeking protection.
And just briefly, because we have less than a minute on this segment, but I wanted to ask you in terms of the penalties that employers of these staffing agencies face. Last week, the Department of Labor found a company called Packer Sanitation Services guilty of having 102 children as young as 13 years old working across eight states, and it only got a $1.5 million fine for that.
Yeah, so the important thing here is that we need more resources put into investigations to ensure that fines and any other penalties can be imposed, and that Congress should be looking at this from a labor perspective. But I would also urge Congress to look at reforming our U.S. asylum laws and our U.S. immigration system overall. The fact is that the asylum system is closing. It's becoming more restrictive, both because of congressional pressure and because the Biden administration is putting more blocks on asylum seekers being able to come here. And we haven't had Congress reform our humanitarian or our family or employment-based visa system in three decades now. That's 30 years where people who are coming here don't have the pathways needed to have a safe, stable life here in the United States. And we have thousands, millions of people who are living here, including children, who are in that tenuous status. Anybody who is in a tenuous status that doesn't have permanent legal status is going to be fearful of reporting labor violations like this. And that vulnerable second-class population in the United States is not something that's healthy for the country, even as immigrants contribute so much to our society, our communities, and our economy.
Well, we want to thank you both so much for being with us, Gregory Chen with the American Immigration Lawyers Association and Hannah Dreyer for your superb expose in the New York Times. We'll link to your piece, Alone and Exploited. And just to read a few lines from that piece to underscore, when HHS checks on all minors by calling them a month after they begin living with their sponsors, data obtained by the Times showed over the last 2 years, the agency could not reach more than 85,000 children. Overall, the agency lost immediate contact with a third of migrant children. Next up, we look at how Brazil's new president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, could play a key role in peace talks to end the war in Ukraine. We'll speak with his foreign policy advisor, Celso Amorim. Stay with us.
Pensei nos marginais, nas mulheres de Paris, mariposas do canal e morcegos da matriz.
A Barca do Sul. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to look at how Brazil's new president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, could play a key effort in peace talks to end the war in Ukraine. China's also sought to mediate negotiations in recent weeks and months, and Lula is set to meet with the Chinese President Xi Jinping at the end of March. When Lula met with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz at the end of January, he said Brazil will work with other nations to help achieve peace in Ukraine, as his country has not taken sides.
My suggestion is that we form a group of countries that will sit at the table with Ukraine and Russia to try to find peace, to try to stop the war. Brazil will make an effort. I already spoke with Macron. I spoke with Scholz. I will speak with other presidents, the United States with President Biden. Then I will find other presidents to talk to about the idea of creating a group of people, institutional, multilateral, G20, G10, G15, to sit down and find peace, because the world needs peace.
Just 2 weeks ago, Lula was in the United States to meet with President Biden, who's pushed Brazil to send weapons to Ukraine. Lula says he told Biden, quote, "I don't want to join the war. I want to end the war." Lula spoke on CNN.
What I believe is that in the case of Ukraine and Russia, it is necessary to have someone talking about peace. It's necessary that we should build up interlocutors to talk with the different parties that are in confrontation. That's my thesis. We need to find interlocutors that could sit with President Putin and show to him the mistake that he made to invade the territorial integrity of the Ukrainian territory. And we have to show to Ukraine that they have to talk more so that we can avoid this war. We have to stop the war.
Lula was speaking to Christiane Amanpour. He told Biden he would not sell weapons or ammunition to Ukraine. After Lula's remarks, White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby was asked to respond in a follow-up interview on CNN.
We don't see any impetus right now to get to the negotiating table. So that's why we are focused on making sure Ukraine has everything they need to be successful on the battlefield, so that if and when President Zelensky says, "I'm ready to sit down," he can do so with some wind at his back. The whole issue at stake in Ukraine, when you get right down to it, is about sovereignty. It's about independence. And how ironic, how hypocritical would it be for the United States in that sort of a frame to be browbeating or trying to, tussle other countries to give more, do more, say more.
This comes as Russia's deputy foreign minister told the Russian news service TASS last week that Moscow took note of Lula's comments, quote, on the subject of possible mediation in order to find political ways to prevent escalation in Ukraine, correcting miscalculations in the field of international security on the basis of multilateralism and considering the interests of all players, he said. For more, we go to the capital of Brazil, Brasilia, to speak with Celso Amorim, the foreign affairs advisor for Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. He previously served as Brazil's foreign minister under Lula. Amorim also served as defense minister under former President Dilma Rousseff. We welcome you back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you start off by talking about the significance of what Lula told Biden about not selling weapons to Ukraine, and the possibility of Lula serving as some kind of mediator, Celso Amorim?
Well, I think, good morning or good afternoon. Good morning, I believe, there in the United States, in the East Coast.
I think the real point is that we don't want to be part of the war. And of course, if you provide ammunition, or actually, we were asked to do that by Germany rather than the United States. But if we provide ammunition, we'll be participating in a war, something that we don't want. That's contrary to our general view in relation to the favoring peace and peaceful means of resolving conflicts. Well, that does not mean that we don't condemn the actions of Russia invading Ukraine, violating its territorial integrity and violating norms of the United Nations Charter. But we think that we must talk about peace. That's absolutely necessary, because if we only talk how to defeat Russia, how to enfeeble or weaken Russia, that will not come to a positive conclusion. I think the war will continue. We'll have certainly a resentful Russia, whoever is the leader, and I think that doesn't bode well for peace in Europe or in the world.
I wanted to ask you, it's not only Brazil, but most of the countries in Latin America have maintained a neutrality and refused to provide weapons to Ukraine. There's been some criticism of some of the countries, but not all. Why do you think that Latin America has charted such a different course on this war?
Well, to start with, we didn't actually even try to coordinate. That was a spontaneous attitude in relation to war. We are a region of peace. We want, by the way, not only Latin America, but South America and the South Atlantic to be a region of peace. So this is not a war in which we are involved, which does not mean that we don't condemn the actions by Russia. I want to stress that once again. But I think more important than condemning or not condemning or trying to weaken Russia or to defeat Russia is to find a way towards peace. That's what we have to do. And nobody was talking about that. We are glad that now some other people are talking, like the Chinese, some others are talking. Great intellectuals like Jürg Habermas in Europe, of course, Pope Francis had done that before, but we want to find a way. Maybe it's not immediately the durable peace we want, but sometime some sort of ceasefire or armistice that can then allow us to get to a peaceful solution to the conflicts which are there, I mean, and whose deep causes are multiple.
There have been other efforts in recent months to mediate a solution. For instance, a former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett of Israel has said he was involved and he thought there was a potential deal last year, but that it was the United States that he believed did not want the war to end at that time. Why do you think that there might be greater success now in the efforts of Lula?
Well, I cannot be sure that there will be greater success, but we have to try. We can't give up. We can't give up on peace. You know, this is a very dangerous situation. You are in the geopolitical center of the world. You may, even if people declare that they're not going to use this or that kind of weapon, we can never be absolutely sure that this will not happen. And so, and apart from that, thousands and thousands of people are dying. And there is a crisis in the world in terms of food crisis. The prices of energy are affecting especially us, the developing world. I mean, for many countries there are alternatives. For developing countries, if you don't have enough to eat, you won't find it somewhere else. So for us, it's absolutely necessary to get peace, and that's why President Lula is speaking. There's no magic formula, but if you have to talk. If you, instead of just thinking of more weapons, greater force, you won't find any solution. You know, I learned with Kofi Annan, who was the Secretary General of the United Nations. You have to talk to everyone, including your adversaries. If you don't talk with your adversaries, the only thing that you have in front of you is conflict, is war, death, and we don't want that.
Celso Amorim, I wanted to ask you about a new movement now over the last year, but very recently, to go after Putin, not only for crimes against humanity and war crimes, but specifically for engaging in war as an act of an aggression. Now, this is very interesting movement. Interestingly, the United States is not a signatory to the International Criminal Court, as Russia isn't either. Britain isn't either. And while it looks like they're pushing for this in the case of Russia attacking Ukraine, they are not pushing for this as a general category, finding leaders guilty of war as an act of aggression. Now, you were the foreign minister under Lula in 2003 when the U.S. invaded Iraq under President Bush. You were fiercely opposed. Lula was opposed to that invasion. What about this category, investigating Putin for this, but also what it means for example, U.S. leaders?
Well, you know, I think if you look for indictment of all the leaders who have started wars that they have, shouldn't have indicted, maybe you wouldn't be able to talk to anyone. I think the most important thing now, I don't want to go into the merits, the specific merits of the possible indictment of one or this or that leader. I think the question is now being able to talk to them and to find a way in which a solution, which will not be an ideal one for anyone. Of course, I agree with those that say that Russia cannot be rewarded for having initiated the war. On the other hand, of course, there are other deep causes that have to be looked at if you want to have a durable peace. But the most important thing is where your efforts are directed. If your efforts are directed to war, to combat, to destroy or at least to weaken your enemy, or if your efforts are directed to fight as soon as possible conditions for peace, which may imply initially some sort of ceasefire, some sort of armistice, so that the deeper questions, this was done in the past. Unfortunately, I'm not going to the merits now, but the Minsk agreements, which somehow were some basis for a conviviality, if not a good one, but at least some coexistence, better said, between Russia and Ukraine, were not followed, not respected. Well, there are accusations on one side or another, but whatever it is, we have to be in search of peace. If we are just in search of war, of defeating your enemy, or indicting or finding a criminal person or a criminal leader, you won't find anywhere. We condemned, of course, the war in Iraq, but we never thought we should bring former President Bush to the International Criminal Court. You know, these are different things. You're now dealing with the need to find a peaceful solution for the world. I mean, moral judgments are very important. I'm not claiming that they should be out, but the most important thing now is to find a peace that is just, that doesn't reward wrong actions, but which still can help the countries to leave there. Because, you know, it's geography. They'll be there. Russia will be a neighbor of Ukraine, whether they like it or not. So we have to find a way for them to leave as well as possible.
Brazil joined the vast majority of the countries in the world on the first anniversary of Russia's invasion in condemning Russia for the invasion. You know, countries like China, South Africa, and others abstained from that vote. So what would that possible agreement, as you're talking about, what would a peace agreement, what could you see it looking like?
Well, I think at this point, as you remember, you voted in favor, but we also made a declarational vote in which we insisted that on the point that nothing should be used to prevent negotiations from starting and going on. Well, President Lula, of course, has several specific ideas, but I think rather than putting them publicly at this stage, we would like to talk to all those involved to see where the resistances are. What is the bottom line, the real bottom line for each side? I mean, otherwise you go into a rhetoric debate and the positions get harder and harder, and the negotiation gets more difficult. That was my experience as a trade negotiator. That was my experience when I also tried to be involved in other negotiations of a political nature. That was the experience that President Lula had. So I think the most important thing is to have an idea how we can at least stop the fighting, stop the killing, and then, of course, move into to the condition for a more durable peace. But we can't do that publicly. It's impossible, because otherwise everyone feels obliged towards their own public opinion to have maximalist positions.
I wanted to ask you, next month, President Lula will be meeting with Chinese leader Xi Jinping at the end of March. China is Brazil's number one trading partner, and China has also recently put forth a 12-point peace plan. What do you think will be the main issues being discussed between Brazil and China, and what is your sense of the Chinese peace plan?
Well, two different aspects there. I mean, of course, there will be a lot to be discussed on trade, investment, technology, environment, and so on. But let us put that aside and for a moment. In relation to the peace plan, of course, there is the peace plan by China. There is a peace plan by Ukraine also that we received 1 or 2 months ago. We want to discuss. There are positive points there. I mean, like the respect for sovereignty, the renunciation to the use of weapons of mass destruction. All this is positive. But, of course, we have to go further than that. But China is a fundamental actor, because in all kinds of negotiations of this sort, you need people who have talk and who are able to have influence on either side. I mean, the United States and France and Germany, of course, have a natural influence on Ukraine, but you have to have countries also that have influence on Russia, and China certainly would be one of them. So we would like to discuss with them to know how much they have discussed with the Russians, and, of course, to expose our own ideas. But China is, of course, a very important partner for Brazil. That does not mean that you'll have to agree with China on everything. For a long time, the United States was the biggest trading partner in Brazil, and still we disagreed on some points. I mean, we tend to work independently. That is the Brazilian tradition.
And in terms of Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited Pretoria last month, and South Africa is currently hosting Russia and China for naval military exercises. South Africa has a long history with Russia and a troubled one with the United States. How does this history shape the alignments of the country today, if at all?
Well, I think it is important to note. The other day I heard also the vice minister or the minister, I'm not sure, of Uganda saying similar things about Europe. And when they were under colonial rule, it was the Soviet Union that helped them, not other countries. But now we have a different situation. And I think we have to look for a peaceful world, a multipolar world in which the rules of the United Nations will be followed. I mean, I, for one, am very much in defense. Of course, we need also a reform of the United Nations. That's very important. But we want the Charter of the United Nations and international law to be respected. So that means that we cannot condone with the invasion of Russia, whatever the motives they have. That's another question. But you have to seek your objectives in a peaceful way, in a way that privileges dialogue, privileges conversation.
We have 5 seconds. But Celso Amarim, I want to thank you for being with us. We're also going to have an interview with you in Spanish and post it on our Spanish website at democracynow.org. Celso Amarim, foreign affairs advisor to Brazil's President Lula. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
At CJSF, we would like to take this opportunity to learn about the importance and significance of Black History Month in Canada. Black Canadians and the communities have been a part of shaping Canada's heritage and identity since the early 1600s, yet their role has been disregarded for many years. This changed in December 1995 when the House of Commons officially recognized February as Black History Month in Canada. Years later, in February 2008, Donald Oliver, the first Black man appointed to the Senate, introduced the motion to recognize the contributions of Black Canadians in February as Black History Month.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.